Welcome back to the Wolf of Queen Street podcast series. Welcome back to the audio podcast or the video series. But before we get into today's episode, I just want to shout out to my sponsors, Job Search QLD. Job Search Queensland is a company that's helping people at the moment find their ideal job, helping them with the tips and tricks needed to get into a job interview, or even when they got the job interview, what they need to do next to be prepared for that situation. And you can find them at jobsearchqld.com. But today I'm happy to have Andrew Armstrong back, the mortgage director from Lighthouse Financial Services. I had AJ back a handful of months ago when we had COVID situation happening and property was going on. And it's been an interesting time because, you know, it feels like every week at the moment, something's different happening in the New Zealand market and the property legislation and all the changes. And I said to AJ a while ago, I need to have him back because obviously he's the mortgage director. How mortgages and applying for mortgages and the rules behind them have changed so much that, you know, normally you talk to your mortgage broker once every year and, you know, things don't change. At the moment, I'm literally talking to AJ every couple of weeks on my own stuff going, what's going on? It's changing. How does that, you know, how does that affect that? And that's why I wanted to bring him back on. So if all of you that is listening or watching out there can see what's happening in the latest space around property and mortgages. So AJ, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Lawrence. Thanks for having me back on. Certainly it's about a year since we last caught up and did one of these. And you're absolutely right. There have been so many changes. It's been an absolute roller coaster. So
it has. There's just been so much change out there at the moment. It's one of those things that's weird enough. Like, you can't say you don't know what's going on in property in New Zealand market or even the Australian market as well, right? It is so front page of the news at the moment. Whether you're in the space of being able to get in or not being able to get in, or you're on the market and doing investments and things like that, it's so drastic from one side to the other side because of where we are at the moment. But I think the biggest thing we've seen over the last 12 months post-COVID, a bit of the dip, but now the market, yeah, just climbing ridiculous. Over 20, 30% capital gain growth. What's it, the last report, the average price in the country, 800,000-900,000 somewhere.
Somewhere around like that.
So the first question, AJ, I've put out to you is, as a first home buyer, so anyone that's listening at the moment that's a first home buyer and goes, okay, I'm going to call up Andrew, I want to buy my first home, how do I go about it at the moment with the house prices being $800,000, $900,000? Where do I stand on what I need, and how do I catch up, you know, with the house growth being so fast?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because we get asked that quite a bit. You know, every day somebody goes, hey, look, I don't have a 20% deposit. The radio, my friends, everyone's just saying you need 20% deposit to even have a chance of getting into the market. Mm-hmm. And actually, the answer to that is most circumstances, you only need a 10% deposit. So for a 10%, you know, on an $800,000 house, that's still a fair chunk of money. Mm-hmm. But if you break it down and go, well, if I have a 5% genuine savings, which is what most banks need where there's a low deposit element, that's $40,000. And if you've been in KiwiSaver for a significant period of time, $40,000 is quite doable. So that's 5%. So the next thing is, where do I get the other 5% from? Normally it comes from the bank of mum and dad, or really good friends if you've got those who are willing to, you know, give you a very generous gift or even a non-interest-bearing loan. Mm-hmm. We've been able to help young professionals, people starting out into properties with a 10% deposit. And just to go on to that, there's actually welcome home loans that are offered by some of the main banks in New Zealand, so TSB and Westpac and so on and so forth, where you can get in there as long as you meet the criteria and the properties are in good condition, with as little as a 5% deposit.
So something interesting, Andrew. So you're talking about the moment is everyone that follows or watches will go, hold on, I need 20% deposit. I need 20% deposit to get my first home. But you're talking about 10%. You're even talking about 5% as an opportunity in there. Why aren't we seeing 10% as your first home as an option? Why aren't we seeing that more mainstream on the news or out there? Is it just because they don't want you to go down that path? Or is it just that you've got to have quite a few tick boxes to actually meet that?
I think it's probably sensationalism in the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to say, well, you know, everyone needs a 20% deposit on $1 million house, than it is to go, well, actually, you know, subject to credit criteria and you know, source of savings and all sort mm-hmm. of lengthy discussion, you can get into a reasonably priced house with 10 or even 5% deposit. It's just, I feel that it's sensationalism
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, you hear, you pick what you choose to hear and on the radio and the media, and you basically feed into what's being said.
Yep.
And if you explore your options, you'll find that, yes, you can get in there with a, you know, considerably less deposit.
I mean, that makes a major difference. Like you said, you know, 800,000 home, 20%, the difference between 20, you know, so it's $80,000 for that additional 10%, right? And if you can get that situation of where it's closer to the 5 or to the 10%, it'll make a big difference to people out there, because I don't believe people are saying, hey, I don't have the $30,000 or $40,000. This is where a lot of people I see at the market going, they're going, hey, I've saved for 2 or 3 years and I've got my 30 or my 40 or my 50 grand. But to go from there to 120 or 140 grand, it's just, I'm going to be chasing my tail for the next 10 years. But it's great to see that that opportunity is still there. There was something else, Andrew, that you just mentioned in that explanation was, if you had 5% as cash and you got 5% from a loan from mom and dad, a mate, or someone that might want to just help you out, you talked about something, and I would like you to just explain this a little bit further because of the impact that could have. You spoke about getting someone to give you a non-interest-bearing loan. So what does that mean, and why do you want it non-interest-bearing?
Yeah, okay, good point. I mean, a lot of times where it's first home and 5%, and it might be that your parents want to help you out,
mm-hmm.
but they you know, financially, they don't want it to be forever because they need it for something else. It might be required for their retirement in 5, 10, however many years, or there may be a partnership in there that should the partnership fall down, the parents want to be able to get some of that money out. A non-interest-bearing, and there's no encumbrance, there's no charge over the house that you're getting, is generally acceptable to most banks in the sense that there's no obligation to repay it
mm-hmm.
On a regular basis, so it doesn't contribute to your outgoing expenses.
So fundamentally, it's mom and dad or the mate going, hey, here's $50,000, and contractually, I'm not stipulating that you've got to pay me at $5,000 a month for the next 10 months. And that's what is documented, which will then obviously be presented to the bank, correct? And the bank then sees that all of a sudden you don't have this additional debt obligation to pay.
Correct, and normally they're repayable on an undetermined time in the future, normally on the sale of said property. So that if you bought a house for $800,000 and then turned around and sold it the next year, or you know, probably 880 or something ridiculous, the way that property prices are going, that person who's lent you the money has an entitlement to be repaid for it.
Okay, so another one on the first homes for the people out there. So let's use an example, right? So I want to buy my first home, and I can only cover up a mortgage of about $500,000. Let's just say my application doesn't mean I'm going 5%, 10%, or 20%. Let's just say I've gone through the bank application and the bank says I can only grab $500,000 through that. And with that $500,000, obviously I can't really buy in Auckland unless I'm buying a one-bedroom apartment. Let's say $500,000 still gets me a three-bedroom house in most of the smaller towns out in the wider New Zealand. Am I able to, currently in the market, able to buy that house outside of the city that I'm living in and not live in it? Will the bank, as a first-time buyer, allow me to do that?
Absolutely an interesting question, because, again, we get quite a bit. It's sort of going, hey, you know, we've got this deposit we can afford in, you know, Wellington, but we live in Auckland and so on and so forth. Generally speaking, no, you can't go on. Buy a property in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
There would be some exceptions, or there are some exceptions to that rule. It's normally around the lines of, do you commute for work?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have other properties? And if you were to buy a first home, genuinely, you know, it is your home because you've got, you know, a good connection to another city. that you're not going to be reliant on rental income from that property. In other words, you know, it's a property, it's your first home, and you're getting into it for the right reasons, of course, not trying to sort of game the system.
So I'm going to put Andrew, some people were heard, I call him AJ, I know him as AJ. I'm going to put AJ on the spot here and see if he's going to answer me and see if he's going to squirm. I'm going to ask him a question where I've been asked this a few times and I don't actually know the answer. I know Andrew, I have some insight. So yeah, another real world example. I have access, again, we're going to use $500,000. I've got access to buy a $500,000 property through KiwiSaver. So obviously through our KiwiSaver, first time home buyers has a deal that goes on with specific numbers. And I'm going to buy the house in, let's say I'm staying in Auckland. So I'm going to buy the house in Hamilton because that's where I can afford it. Now, KiwiSaver or the first time buyers on KiwiSaver says I need to live in that house. Is it not for, I think, 6 months, correct?
Yep. There's a provision for the amount of time that you can live in it.
Yep. So I am going to go and I'm going to buy this house for 6 months and I am going to not live in it, but I'm going to redirect my mail to it and I'm going to go and stay there a couple of weekends a month. And yeah, and I'm going to ask the question in the sense of, and to see if AJ is going to give me an answer, is that enough?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and I really don't want to put my foot in it here, but it's going to come down to the nature of it, right? So you intend to live in it, but it's your first home, it's your only home, you know, hand on heart, you don't own another property.
Yep,
and again, you're not going to be relying on it for rental income, so there's no assessment there. And, you know, should you get tested, should you get checked, then, you know, there cannot be a tenant there. Then possibly. I'm not going to say yes. I'm not going to say no.
I didn't expect you to give me, but like I said, I'm asking the question that everyone wants to ask and everyone wants to know, right? So.
Yeah. Again, you know, it comes down to bank policy, how the bank sees it. Do you have a reason to be in Hamilton when you live in Auckland or vice versa? We come across quite a few people who, believe it or not, would commute.
Yep.
Maybe not to Hamilton or Auckland because it's... the weekly commute. In other words, go home on the weekend, lock up. But remember, you have to be able to afford to live in both cities.
Yep.
So you have to be able to afford the rent on the wherever you're staying in Auckland, and not receive rent on the property that you have in.
I totally get that, but I mean, if I'm buying it and I'm sleeping on mom and dad's couch, and the interest rates are 2.29% on $500,000, you know. The rent for 6 months is only, you know, what I would have been paying if I was renting a 3-bedroom house somewhere. So it's just a bit of an interesting situation for people out there. And I know that there must be people out there looking at this opportunity or looking and thinking about how they can get around that specific spot.
Yeah. And I mean, I think probably the best way to approach it is, what is the property? If you don't need KiwiSaver to do it, and I think this probably leads into the part of our next topic, so I might be jumping the gun here, but you can get into investment properties with a 10% deposit as long as you buy the right investment property.
Yep.
So, you know, you don't necessarily have to try and skirt around it where you just go straight ahead and go direct and tell them what you want, why you want it.
Yeah, so, I mean, it totally is where I wanted to go next and talking about, obviously we covered off in our first-time buyers, but let's go into first-time investors. So obviously first-time investors, as in actually I'm buying. So there's two types of first-time investors. Now I'll let AJ explain how both currently work as it stands at the moment and where sort of the ways are. There's the first-time investor where he already owns his own home and is then looking to buy his first investment. And then secondly, there's the first-time investor who actually lives in Auckland, like myself, and wants to buy an investment in Timaru, Invercargill, Christchurch, for example, as well, because I can find a good deal there. And fundamentally, it is an investment because I'm putting tenants in there and it's making me a cash flow. So those are the two ways there is at the moment. And AJ, let's talk through those.
Yeah. So, you're right there. So first time investment, let's say you don't own any property, but you want one. And like what we were talking about before, you're thinking about going, well, I'll tell the bank and KiwiSaver and I'm going to live in it, but I never do. And, you know, and potentially that could cause you, you know, downstream effects. Or we just go, hey, we've got the 10% deposit. I want to go and buy a new build, for example. And, you know, one of these turnkey off, well, off the plan. One property, for example, at Williams Court, they sell a ton of properties throughout New Zealand, Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch. And you go, hey, look, I live in Auckland. I want to buy an investment property in Christchurch because I've got 10% in cash.
Yep.
So subject to, obviously, the right approval and the right bank and the relationship there, you can get in there with an approval to buy that property. And that might be being bought, you know, 10% down, settlement in 8 months or 12 months or whenever it's going to settle.
So, but as it's your first investment, so in this example, so I just want to talk this through because there'll be people going, hold on, but as an investor that owns properties, I've got a 60% LVR. How does a first-time investor only have to do 10% deposit? So how is it that they have that access, but I don't have that access? I can't go to 10% deposit now on investment as an existing investor. So what's the reason behind that? Is that just that the bank wants to get them in?
It's largely along the sort of government regulations and the rules of the Reserve Bank. Mm-hmm. I think the nature before, no, I think the nature behind it is that they want to encourage investment into new build properties. They simply want enough people buying new versus buying older existing properties. So that's part of the reason behind it.
So is the rates differently from a deposit requirement on new build to older homes?
Yeah, so older homes or existing homes, you generally need to have a 40% deposit or up to 40% available equity in your existing property. So, for example, Lawrence, you might have $1 million property, and you might have had $600,000 loan. We're doing really simple, easy maths on it.
Yep.
Before the LVR has changed to requiring a 40% deposit, let's say this time last year, you could go up to 80% against existing homes. That would mean that you've got $200,000 available equity to go towards the next purchase. Now, if the rules change down to 60, you don't have anything because it's been essentially wiped out, they've lowered the bar.
Yeah, so fundamentally, what you're saying there as, you know, first-time investor thinking about it at the moment, without, you know, you might not realize that it's new builds as much as, now, I'm not going to go too much in the sense of the numbers and the cash flow and that sort of stuff, but new builds, obviously, you're going to be paying a little bit more and that stuff. But that stepping stone to get there is only 10% compared to 40%. Now, remember, and I said the average house price in the country is $900,000. In the smaller towns outside of the main cities, that might be $400,000, $500,000, $600,000. So you can get into investment at, let's say $50,000 to $60,000 for a new build. But if you did it as an investment, you would require $100,000, $120,000, $140,000 for the similar thing as well. So that's obviously why there's a opening there. We think from investment to going to the new builds.
Yeah. I mean, that's the general way of doing it. There are other near bank or non-bank lenders, depending which way you want to sort of set it. They have competitive rates and they have methods in which you can actually get 80% on an investment property to go and buy another existing investment property at 80% LVR. So we work with a lot of investors who are able to achieve that. And it just simply goes, hey, we're going to take a bit of a risk. We're going to take it out of a standard bank. Our goal is so that we're happy to take higher risk or higher interest rates, not necessarily higher risk, but higher interest rates, to leverage up to 80% LVR again on both properties and increase our property holdings and existing rental properties. At the same time, if you're wanting to get additional money to go buy a new build, you could refinance an investment property that's sitting at 60% LVR up to 80% LVR and use the additional cash out, essentially, a withdrawal as a deposit on a new build with a main bank or any other lender.
Yeah. So I just want to, it's great that you're talking about the second tier lending. I just wanted to go back to that point out there. So sometimes people don't realize that exists and there's multiple tiers. You know, I got shown this as well, talking to AJ I mean, AJ's my broker, if you haven't picked that up already, and it manages all my accounts, is that there were situations talking about going, hey, mainstream banks not giving you the answer. But then you've got the non-mainstream banks and people that don't know get a bit skittish. They go, oh, how can I borrow money from someone that's not a bank? And it's like, well, the only reason we borrow money from a bank or we work with a bank is because we've been educated that a bank's the only place that goes to that has money, that an actual bank. But there's actually other finance institutions out there, and they are underpinned by the same credit rating systems as what banks are. So you can go and look and see, okay, how secure is this company or how secure is this financial institution from the Moody ratings and so forth? Do they have an A+, A-, triple B rating, whatever? But the thing is, when you go into that second tier, as AJ was saying, to give you that opportunity, because they're giving you more buying power, they only got 80% on the LVR compared to 60% for mainstream, is they charge you more. So instead of paying your 2.229s, 2.249 interest rates, I don't know, AJ, what's current 12 months going on second tier? 6%, somewhere around there?
No, it's actually not that high. You'd think so, right? Everyone's, again, this is what people don't understand, is that you can get an Airbank lender on an 80% LVR at, anywhere from 2.99% per annum fixed for sort of 2 years. Going on from that, you can get floating at sort of 3.49, and it sort of goes up from there. So the perception that you have to pay 6% or 9% or 10% is absolutely wrong. And the other thing is, if you become one of the clients of these non-bank lenders, mm-hmm. and you can build your property portfolio and you show that you're a good risk to them, chances are they will actually review it over the long term, and with any luck, you get a slight reduction in those higher rates anyway.
But just listen to what you said, and I'm quite surprised. So my brain's ticking over 100 miles an hour. Just as you said, that is second tier lending, which allows me to do 20% less deposit to go into an investment option, and they're charging me almost only 1% more than what my mainstream banks are currently, right? Outside of ASB and Heartland, what they've done on the side at the moment as we stand, most of the other banks are still in the low 2%. And you're just saying, there's a 2.99 or in the 3% for second tier lending. So that's 20% less deposit, which could be $80,000 to $100,000 less you're required. And all you're paying more is 1% on that mortgage.
Yeah. And often, believe it or not, another point of perspective is that the rates that they offer are going to be less than your standard advertised bank floating rates. So again, it's a perception thing, and it's just a discovery thing.
That's an amazing one. And I think that's where a lot of people out there at the moment, that's hopefully will get the right education in the sense of that, will take this and go, that is where is the little hole that I'm looking for. Not the hole, the hole in the system, but that is the step that I can follow by going in that one to take it. Because like I said, I used the number 6 because I used to think that they'll float in at 5 and 6. And then you went up to the next one of sort of big commercial lending. And then those numbers even went higher, 8, 9, 10% and so forth. But the number's been so close and actually getting so much more. You almost look at yourself and go, why would I go mainstream bank? Why would I go to ASB, BNZ, and all those people,
Yeah. It's just as long as it meets what you're wanting to achieve, does it serve a purpose? Does it match your goals? There's plenty of options. There's plenty of opportunity to get ahead.
So I guess what we've just spoken about at the moment will cover the person that as well owns the existing home, right? So if they own the existing home and they want to get into investments, they will obviously just leverage the equity at the percentage of what they're trying to do, correct? So if they mainstream bank and they want to go to an investment, they have to go to 60% LVR if it's a older home, or 80% LVR if it's a new build. Is that correct? Or 90%,
up to 90. Generally speaking, you're probably, for new builds anyway, you want to be around the 80% mark. If you've got existing equity, you get preferential rates, and you've got more main bank lenders available to you. But it's really just a matter of having a look, seeing what options are available, and just review it. We often sit down and have these chats. Well, you know, from your experience, we go, hey, your property's a X, Y, and Z value. This is where it sits at 60%. Mm-hmm. If you take this property and consider it at this, you know, 80% LVR, this is the type of outcome you could expect. So we certainly, yeah.
So another one I want to add in here at the moment, right, with the massive growth that we're seeing at the moment. So we're going to use an example. Obviously, when you go to the bank, it's not just the – so let's I'm talking about investments now. It's not just the deposit, whether it's a cash deposit or equity the bank looks at. It's also the cash flow possibility of the property. Is the property driving cash flows? In other words, does the rent cover all the expenses? And therefore, it looks better on the person that's taken out the loan. And sometimes it's negative, whether that's by choice or by how the marketplace or the banks, you know, if you're too negative, the bank's like, hey, you can't buy that house because you're actually having to pay $5,000 more a month and you really struggle to pay your bills. But I want to know, AJ, has the banks at the moment, because the growth is so drastic, 12 months apart or 6 months apart at the moment, it's, you know, it's 6%, it's like crazy, 2-4% a month, some of the areas, that properties that might be on that brink, normally they would said, hey, the cash flow is quite not well enough. Are they being more lenient now at the moment because they know that the capital gain growth is so drastic that in 6 months' time, the property is that's going to be bought for 800,000, it's going to be worth 850 or 880, and all of a sudden there's a lot more equity there as well?
Yeah, I mean, you'd think so, but ultimately banks, you know, have a way that they can quickly assess how much you can borrow, mm-hmm. and they'll go, hey, what's your total income? What's your total debt? What's your total new debt or proposed mortgage debt at a set test rate?
Yep.
And does that fall within, you know, a green light or a red stop sign? I think it's really up to you as an investor to run your numbers, because you might have a really high personal income and you're buying a property that actually doesn't produce anything or produces a negative yield, but the bank will still say yes.
Yep.
So it's important that you run your numbers, you talk to your financial advisor, your accountant, for example, or even just know your figures. Lawrence, you're pretty good at being able to, you know, figure it out yourself. So, you know, you run your figures to make sure it works. The bank's simply going to take the data, mm-hmm. inputs, and go, yes, you can afford it based on total inputs.
Thanks, saying I know my numbers. I know my numbers because AJ taught me what to look at. So as much as I wish I know my numbers, it's different when you... I'm going through an application right now for my own personal house. I'm busy looking to build a new family home. And as much as I know the major numbers, the banks look a lot more granular depending on your application. So it's... I won't say all the stuff, but it's quite funny. AJ and his team are emailing me and going, Lawrence, what's this on your bank statement? What's this on your bank statement? And the bank's literally going through 12 months lines and looking at line by line of what you're doing. And I'll mention the one example because people out there will, my kids do maths and there's this program called Kumon. It's a very large, big program, and a majority of kids that I'm from friends of mine I know all go to it, but it's a monthly payment. So I just do an AP every month straight to their company for my kids. And the bank came back and went, hey, you've got a monthly payment to this and we don't recognize it. What is this? And they're thinking it's some expense payment. They think it's some finance card because it's some weird name. And that's where they're going to know the numbers. So as much as AJ says, I know my numbers, that's because he's taught me, and I usually spit it to him and then he spits it back with his tools and goes, okay, this is exactly how it looks. But the high level stuff is simple to look at.
Yeah. And just sort of on top of that, I think what's changed over the last 12 months is that the banks are really, they're not all doing it, but quite a few of them are really deep diving and sort of having a look at your statements and seeing what your real expenses are versus what you've sort of put on an application form. Because, you know what you roughly spend and you can quite happily put that down. But what they're more and more doing these days is actually really sitting down and going, well, this is what you say, but we're just going to have a quick look through them and hunt for things like automatic payments, direct credits, anything that says Gem Visa or something that would indicate that it's a finance card.
Yeah.
And again, we can still get through nice and simply, but they are looking more into it these days.
So let's go into another point. Let's use my actual example, right, without going into the finer details. So we talked about first-time investors, first-time owners, going into investment, depending where you are. What about existing owners like myself in my example? And I go, hey, AJ, I want to do a major renovation. Or I want to build a new house, what I'm doing at the moment. What is the currently the bank's expectations around that sort of stuff to get that finance?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, very good question, very valid, obviously, because you and I have been doing working on this a wee bit recently. And so they want to know what the picture is today. So in other words, what's your income like? What's your income and expenses? What's going to happen? What's it going to look like in the future?
Yep.
And how are we going to bridge that gap? How are we going to get there? So for, you know, your example, we just, you know, you too, you wanted to know what the bill would be at the end of it. If you spend a certain amount of money on a new house, plus whatever your existing debt is and your existing land value, you want to know that it all stacks up. So in other words, at the end of the day, you know, when the dust settles and the triple C's issued, are you going to have a house that's worth what you paid for it?
Yep. And so not overcapitalizing, right? That's something that's we sometimes forget, because when it's our personal home, it's personal decisions, and sometimes we don't think about the number going. And talking about overcapitalization, if you don't know about it, is if a property in this area is worth $1 million and you go and spend $1.5 million, the likelihood is you've overspent to the value of what you'd be able to do to get it back. Because it doesn't matter if you spend $20 million in a house, you're not going to be able to sell it for $20 million. Not necessarily. And we don't see it as much in New Zealand, in the marketplaces. I haven't seen a lot in my experience here, as overcapitalization. People are quite well aware of it, but overseas in America, I think in the UK as well, there's a lot more in that marketplace of people overcapitalizing, and then you're stuck because you've spent $1 million and it's only going to only be worth it 800,000. So you've got to wait 5 years to catch up.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what I actually find here more so, and again, it's a change in, I guess, tides or credit policy from banks. In the past, you could go and get your budget done, or you go and get your costs and fixed price contract, and then you go to the bank, and yes, they say, yeah, you know, go ahead, and but subject to evaluation. More and more these days, they're saying, hey, give us a valuation first, show us that you're committed to the deal, and then we'll assess it. Which actually, you know, if you think about it, it helps you make sure that you're protected from spending too much on a project to begin with. So if you know you know that based on this house, this area, in this location, it's only going to be worth set price, you just work backwards and go, well, you know, the project has to cost me.
Yep. So that's fundamentally almost how I had to go in the situation, right? So I'm not going down the normal path of doing it, but in my situation, we did a valuation up front to make sure that we knew before going to the bank that that number would line up from what we're trying to build and so forth. Because there was no point in going to the bank and, hey, bank, I want $5. And the bank goes, hey, I'm not going to give you the $5 anyway because your numbers aren't going to stack up. So we went and AJ organized to get the valuation done so we could see the number. So then we knew that we went to the bank wouldn't say, will it value up? They just had to make sure that the finances aligned to be able to take out that new debt.
Yeah, exactly.
So last one, AJ, I'm going to hit you with at the moment is, as we are recording this, in the last 24 hours, ASB has announced a new rate, 1.79, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 1.79%
for new builds. And a few conditions. I'll let you talk to it and talk to about what it is, what are they offering, what's the conditions, the loopholes and so forth around this crazy 1.79% mortgage.
Yeah, it's pretty sensational, really. Coming out with that first thing on Monday, you'd imagine the kind of emails that we're seeing. And then obviously in the sort of wider networks and everyone's talking about it, and it's just about every second post on Facebook at the moment. You know, and it's exciting. Without going too much into the nitty-gritty, you're looking at 1.79 on a floating rate, up to 3 years for a new build or a turnkey. So I mentioned turnkey before. That's where you buy a property with a 10% deposit, come up with the rest on settlement. So under the sort of guidelines there, that be suitable. So in other words, you've got a brand new house, you've got a low interest rate, it's on floating, of course, for up to 3 years. I think the fallback to that is that often banks will also offer a cash contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to weigh up what is the cash contribution versus what is the savings. A 1.79 versus a 2.25% fixed rate, for example.
So the only thing I'm going to ask on this one, right? So, and like I said, it's literally just out in the last 24 hours or so forth, so that it's so new out there, and everyone is that I've spoken to since then has gone great. It's almost free money. 1.79% is almost nothing, right? But it's a variable rate. So what is, have they in the fine print stipulated how quickly they can change it? So let you, AJ, explain what a variable rate is compared to a fixed rate.
Yeah, okay. So variable rate is exactly that. Can vary. It tends to follow whatever the official cash rate is in one form or another. So if the official cash rate were to increase by, 0.25 to 50, then it's highly likely that the variable rate will increase. It doesn't necessarily mean it will increase at the exact same portion.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if the official cash rate, so that's the government set, Reserve Bank set rate, if that were to go up 0.25, but ASB says, look, we're going to put it up 0.3 or 0.5, you're effectively going to do what ASB says.
Mm-hmm.
They will give you warning, give everyone warning, so they can't just be like, surprise. Your variable rate is now 4%. Yep. Congratulations. They're going to give notice. They have to give everyone a fair amount of warning, which allows you to make a decision. Fixed price or fixed interest rate, for example, 1 year,
mm-hmm.
You're locking in that rate, 2.25, for example, for one whole year. And if the rates go up to 2.5% during the year, too bad, you're fixed. Or, good for you, you're fixed at 2.25 for the rest of the year.
So it feels like they're trying to grab at a corner of the market, get you in the door, hold on for 12 months, and hopefully the new Kiwis, some part of Kiwis that are loyal to banks, I see it with friends. I've been with the same bank for 20 years. I've been in the same bank for 15 years. I'm not going to leave and move. They're hoping to achieve that with this sort of 1.79% on a new build. To take that part of the market. And then in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, when the variable rate changes or they change this plan, they've got that part of the market.
Yeah. I mean, yes. But as you know, people change banks. People mm-hmm. change banks. Like, I think the sort of average length of tenure for a bank is reasonably short,
yep.
believe it or not. It's around sort of the four-year mark. People are chopping and changing between banks for whatever reason. But... Yeah, I think it's a good way for ASB to generate some noise in the market. It's certainly appealing to a lot of people, especially the hype around buying new properties.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it should garner some customer loyalty. Think about it. You're helping, they're helping people into it, into first homes and first investment properties, for example. I think everyone's pretty excited about it. Whether or not other banks follow suit, mm-hmm. who knows? I would imagine that, that there'll be some sort of bun fight coming up where, another one of the banks will have a
go at it as well.
Yeah, another interesting offer. It just makes for an interesting time in our role in the sort of mortgages and finance market where we're trying to manage expectations of the customer, and then all of a sudden we've got a 1.79% rate just sort of pop up on a Monday, and we're like, oh, okay, well, we've got your approval with another bank, and then have to sort of, not defend a position, but justify
yep.
the fact that, your loan's already drawn with said bank. It was great last week. You were happy last week. It's just created another scenario.
I can imagine anyone out there. I mean, I'm in the same situation. I called AJ straight away and going, hey, my current application that I know that you're busy working on, how about an ASB deal? How does that look? And he knew that I was going to ask that question. So,
I'm surprised it took you so long. Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a few hours to get to him. So he knew it was coming, but I'm more realistic. I'm more realistic in that sense, being around the block a few times, that I'm not going to chase a deal when I could risk if someone else says yay. If someone says yes in the beginning, I'm going to go for it and just go down the path, because I know that things can go no very quickly as well. But AJ, before I shut down the show for today, there was just one point that you spoke about there, and it's quite interesting. You know, I was talking about bank loyalty. You were talking about people looking to shift every 4 years. I think since I've met AJ, I think I've spoken, moved, looked at different banks literally every 3 months. And that's not a bad thing, because I've got AJ doing it and that. And people are like, but how do you shift and how do you change? And what about the cost and all that stuff? The thing is, because I've got the right person in my team, I shift because I get the right answer that I'm looking for. And fundamentally, 99.9% of the time, it doesn't cost me a cent, because I go to a bank and they give me money coming over, or they cover a cost to pay for my lawyers to transfer things over and stuff like that. So don't ever worry about, hey, if I move bank, how is that gonna change? Speak to the likes of AJ or your broker or your specialist that should be telling you that moving banks shouldn't be the showstopper. If there's another bank or another institution that's going to give you that yes for what you're trying to achieve, then go there. The loyalty is not going to get you that far in the banks. The loyalty is coming to you and your broker that does the deals for you.
Exactly. And we often say, look, don't be distracted by all the sort of fancy lights from Bank Z and, you know, Y and T. Have a chat to your existing bank, see what they can do. There's a reason why you're there in the first instance.
Yep.
And don't be distracted from, you know, what your ultimate goal is, what your ultimate purpose of being with that bank is, because, you know, it possibly could lead you off path.
Awesome. But anyway, AJ, as always, thanks so much. Can you let our listeners or watchers know where they can find you at the moment, around on social media or on a website?
Yeah. So we've got my email address, of course, is AJ. It's probably not that obvious yet, but AJ at Financial Lighthouse. Sorry, try that again. AJ at lighthousefinancial.co.nz. We've got our website, lighthousefinancial.co.nz as well. Google, we're on. You can find us by just simply searching, and I'm sure Lawrence will leave our details in the notes there.
As always, there's details out there. You know, as with all the other ones and people that I get on the show, like I said, I've had AJ on before. He's my broker. He's been look after me since my medical problems I had, and sorted all my shit out and got me a lot into where I am now. I'm not saying if you're looking at, you have to go to AJ. I never say that. I don't say to anyone I speak out there that you have to go to this person. I mean, you have to go to that person. But what you have to do is you have to find a person in the right in that right area to give you that guidance. Because I'm seeing it so much of people out there at the moment, whether it's in their property or in business or in their lives and stuff like that, is they're making decisions outside of the box that they understand and think they are right making that right decision. And it's only when you meet someone that actually works outside that box's area that you go, that's how it works. Yeah. And as always, one thing just to drop there is the last little note, AJ works for free. So, you know, I think we should have mentioned that in the beginning, AJ. I think we forgot about that. All right. AJ doesn't, I don't pay AJ. It's all covered by the bank. It's all there. So as you know, but we mentioned that on the last time you were on the show as well. So it's a big thing as well. So he does all that work because he loves me and not because I pay him to do it. So, but as always, AJ, thanks so much for coming on the show and everything else. And I hope everyone else that's listening or watching picked up some more insights. I even did this time from this episode, and go out there and look at what you're doing around your property game, first home or investment as well.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, stay beautiful and stay powerful. Until next time, see ya.